May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be found acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Good morning. It's wonderful to be back with you at Marsh Chapel for the second time this summer. When I was here 2 months ago, I ended my sermon not exactly on a cliffhanger, but with a challenge. We were talking about Jesus saying about the old wine and the new wineskins and sewing an unshrunk piece of cloth on an old garment. And we were talking, too, about the rapid decline in church attendance that we're facing at this moment in American Christian congregations. And I ended my sermon by sort of throwing down the gauntlet and saying that it was our choice in our congregations either to cling to what we know and to allow nostalgia to continue to corrode our institutions until we've dwindled down to nothing, or to make the choice to follow Jesus into a new way of being disciples, welcoming in new seekers after the gospel who long for healing and liberation and authentic relationship with God, and reshaping our existing communities and even founding new communities to meet the pressing spiritual needs of this age. So I sort of threw it down there in June, and then I went on vacation for a while with my family. And as this date approached, I started hearing from some of my colleagues, and I also had heard from a few members of this congregation after the service saying, you know, hey, I'm really interested in like the next part about the future of the church. And I think a few of my colleagues were sort of reminding me to actually get there and saying, you know, you better deliver on what you promised, because we're all going to be listening for it. So here we are. And just a few weeks ago, I don't know if some of you saw, there was a really excellent opinion piece in The Atlantic by a Christian writer called Jake Meador, titled, "The Misunderstood Reason Millions of Americans Stopped Going to Church." Jake Meador, like us, is trying to understand why 40 million Americans, about 12% of the U.S. population, have stopped attending church in the past 25 years, the largest concentrated change in church attendance in American history. And this decline in attendance now affects all churches, all denominations, liberal, conservative, mainline, fundamentalist, Roman Catholic. Everybody is now in this boat. And Meador notes that this is not just bad news for those of us who are concerned that the religious institutions that shaped us and helped sustain our faith are not going to be there for another generation, but that it's also, he writes, bad news for America as a whole, because participation in a religious community generally correlates with better health outcomes and longer life, higher financial generosity, and more stable families, all of which are desperately needed in a nation with rising rates of loneliness, mental illness, and alcohol and drug dependency. He calls this the great de-churching. Meador cites research that says that though religious abuse and more general moral corruption have driven people away, that much of the attrition is due to more banal and cultural reasons. He writes, contemporary America simply isn't set up to promote mutuality, care, or common life. Rather, it's designed to maximize individual accomplishment as defined by professional and financial success. And then one of his key points, workism reigns in America, and because of this, community in America, religious community included, is a math problem that doesn't add up. So he's looking not only at faith communities, but also all sense of community, volunteer community, the communities that we have in our neighborhoods, in our schools, and all our institutions. And I have to say that his observations correlate to what myself and many of my colleagues have observed in our parishes. Long work weeks, the expectation that employees will be reachable outside of the 9-to-5 puts a strain on all volunteer activities of many families, many working adults. The culture of workism puts a strain on already overfull weekends, and honestly on all pursuits that are not tied to paid employment. I do want to note, which MEDOR does not, that workism, of course, affects different populations very differently. There are some groups of people that have more of a choice about how to respond to the demands that are placed on them by their employers. There are other populations that do not have a choice, and as wages have stagnated over the last 40, 50 years, it's harder and harder for people to make ends meet. So I don't want to imply that this is just something that every person could decide, well, I'm going to break free from this culture of valuing paid work so highly, because some people are caught in a trap and their labor is being exploited by their employers. MEDOR continues that this pattern of life is in our wider culture is ultimately not fulfilling for many people. And he writes, the problem in front of us is not that we have a healthy, sustainable society that doesn't have room for church. The problem is that many Americans have adopted a way of life that's left us lonely, envious, and uncertain of how to live in community with other people. And further, the tragedy of American churches is that they have been so caught up in the same world that we now find they have nothing to offer those suffering people that can't be more easily found somewhere else. American churches have too often been content to function as a kind of vaguely spiritual NGO, an organization of detached individuals who meet together for religious services that inspire them, provide practical life advice, or offer positive emotional experiences. Too often it has not been a community that through its preaching and living bears witness to another way to live, end quote. So I've just done something that I often really dislike in the sermons of other people. I've quoted something at length, and I've taken a really long time to actually get to the biblical text, and that annoys me, so I'm sorry if you are annoyed, but we're going to get there, and I'm not going to quote things anymore. And I read this because I just think this is such an important piece for people who love the church, who love the Lord, who want religious community, Christian community to thrive, who want to be out in the world living in a new way. It's an important critique for us to hear. And we need to hear it, as difficult as it is. And it doesn't mean that our local congregations aren't doing wonderful ministry in the world, but at a certain point we have to face that there's not going to be a great rechurching all of a sudden, just that someday this is going to happen, that we have to pay attention to these trends and make a plan. The church in every age lives out its witness in a particular cultural context. And the call of the church in every age is to resist those elements that are not in line with the gospel of Jesus Christ, and to model another way forward, a countercultural pattern of life and community nourished and strengthened by the word and sacraments. The reasons for the congregational decline in the last 25 years are complex. Some of them we can't do anything about. We're caught in the wave of history, and we have to ride it out the best we can. But this does not mean that we should be fatalistic. After all, we're Christians, and we don't believe in fate. That was part of Greek religion that the believers in Jesus rejected. We believe in the power of the Holy Spirit inspiring us and calling us into a deeper and wider witness to Christ's love, living and active in the world. The late great Christian writer Phyllis Tickle said that every 500 years or so, the church has a giant rummage sale. And this is not the first time in our 2,000-year history that the church has conformed perhaps too closely to the patterns of this world, or that there was a growing mismatch between what the church was offering and what the world needed from it. And so Phyllis Tickle said, at these moments, Christian churches and institutions have tended to have this great sort of decluttering, this great like Marie Kondo moment, and movements have sprung up that simplified and stripped down to the essential elements of faith and practice. I'm a scholar of religion and literature, and I've been thinking lately about the way that this played out in the High Middle Ages in the 13th and 14th centuries. I think often we think of, you know, the Great Rummage Sale as something like the Protestant Reformation, but if you study church history, you know that this has happened a number of times along the way. And in the High Middle Ages, it took the form of what has been called the Vita Apostolica, or the Life of the Apostles. And there was this moment in Europe when the monasteries and the convents had become very wealthy over the centuries, and when the ideal life of the monk or nun was very cloistered and was really focused on private prayer, contemplative prayer that took place really within the monk, monastery or convent. And a few hundred years before the Protestant Reformation, there was a growing movement in many of the nations of Europe of medieval women and men who felt that this was not really how Jesus wanted everyone to live, that Jesus in his own life had combined the active life and the contemplative life. He had gone off to pray alone, but he had also been out among the crowds, preaching, teaching, healing, and serving people, lifting up the needs of the poor. And different women and men felt that that is what they should be doing as well. So this is the age of St. Francis and his movement of friars. It's the age of a group of lay women called the Beguines, who were single women who were not wives, they were not nuns. They supported themselves by their work, and they lived in community, and they also took care of the poor. They educated orphans, they ministered to the dying. And then a little later, a group called the Brothers and Sisters of the Common Life, who lived in sort of small households, who did not make permanent vows, but they lived collectively, and their mission was to serve. And so I find myself wondering, what would a Vita Apostolica look like in our own day? What's interesting to me about these groups, the Franciscans, the Beguines, the Brothers and Sisters of the Common Life, is that they were not acting against the institutional church of their day, but they were very much challenging it. And they were not allowing its systems and structures to define the scope of their ministry. Their way of life was provocative to the bishops and the leaders of their day. There's some papal edicts that were against some of those groups at different times. They were sort of the loyal opposition. All three of these groups highly valued simplicity as they saw it expressed in the lives of Jesus and the apostles. The High Middle Ages were a time of great economic change in Europe, including the rise of the money economy as opposed to a barter economy. Suddenly there was cash in play. And it was also the beginnings of capitalism. So those following the Vita Apostolica were critics of the new economic system. They saw it as exploitative of the poor, and they saw it as idolizing wealth above the worship of God, and they lived their lives in a countercultural way against it. When I talk about simplicity, or sometimes it was called voluntary simplicity, what I mean is right relationship with time, money, food, and possessions. So all of these groups, and even in our own day, you know, groups like the Shakers or the Quakers or even the Catholic Workers, Christian groups that value simplicity, it's often about time, money, food, and possessions. The real earthy, nitty-gritty stuff of decision-making in daily life. As it happens, those four categories are pretty connected to climate change. So there you go. There are also four categories on which I've heard very little from most preachers in Christian education programs. Another way of thinking about what simplicity means in a Christian context is right relationship with God, with each other, and with the earth. Not in an abstract sense, but on the level of our individual and collective choices. And I know from my experience teaching mostly young adults at Harvard Divinity School that these are issues that young adults are really wrestling with in their own lives, and they want guidance on them. And even those who do not identify as people of faith, they want to know what the religions of the world, including Christianity, have to say on money, food, time, and possessions, and how we should be using these things. Are we in our churches helping people to live more intentionally and with greater faithfulness in all of these relationships, in their relationship with God, but also in primary relationships as spouses and partners, as parents, as children, siblings, friends, co-workers and colleagues, as citizens? Are we empowering our members to not just survive, but to thrive in these relationships? Are we creating spaces in our churches where we can have deep conversations about these relationships and the responsibilities that they entail, where we can study the scriptures together on these issues? Are we equipping people to make the tough choices, sometimes the seemingly impossible choices that we are called to make in this world of rampant consumerism? Are we coming together to talk about our money and how God would have us spend it? Often the only thing you hear about money in congregations is that you should pledge, to the annual pledge campaign. That's important, but I don't think that's in the Bible, actually, that guidance on money. Are we coming together to talk about our individual vocations as Christians? We each have gifts. How are we to use our gifts for the greater good? How are we to live a meaningful life in such a world of harm and despair? Jesus had a lot to say on all of these topics, and so have theologians over the centuries. And everyday people are really interested in these topics. Or are most of our church gatherings focused on small talk and socializing, or on maintaining our aging buildings? I'm not against either coffee hour or building maintenance, and I have logged countless hours doing each of those things. But too often in our congregations, the purely social things or the facilities meetings can tend to run the show and have the highest places of honor on our agendas. Which brings us, at really long last, to the gospel for today. The story of Jesus walking on the water and gutsy, impulsive, recklessly faithful Peter, who asks Jesus to call him out of the boat onto the waves. He asks him to let him come to him. And Peter climbs out of the boat, and he actually takes a few steps. He does it. And then he becomes afraid, and the wind and the waves make him cower. And Jesus criticizes Peter, saying, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" But as I encounter this story this time around, I find myself thinking, in Peter's defense, at least he knew what to do. At least he knew who to reach out for. Do we, in the American church, do we? In so many congregations and denominations, I hear the issue of decline framed as sink or swim. And for many churches, the response to our challenges has been to try to tread water as long as possible. But that's not our call. There's a third option available to us beyond sink or swim. We need to reach out to Jesus whose hand is already extended to us, who is waiting for us to reach towards him. And we need to ask ourselves, if we're patterning our lives on his life, if we are adopting the practices of the apostles and the early church as our own, are we doing that? Or are we mostly stuck in the patterns of 20th century churchianity? It's not churchianity. It's Christianity. And some of our congregations and even some of our denominational leaders have forgotten that. Our call is not just to persist as long as we can doing what we've always done until the money runs out and there's no one left to take care of the building. Our call is to make disciples and to live as disciples ourselves. In the reading from the Hebrew Scriptures, we heard the story of Elijah hearing the voice of the Lord, not from the great wind or from the earthquake or from the fire, but from the sound of sheer silence. It's a beautiful passage. It's a poetic passage. And often in the mainline churches where I usually am, that's where we like to end the story. Isn't it beautiful? Sound of sheer silence. It's so peaceful. But that's not the end of the story. The end of the story is actually really disturbing. The voice that comes out of the sound of sheer silence, the still small voice, has something really big and loud and profound to say to Elijah. First, it asks Elijah this question two times. What are you doing here, Elijah? In other words, why are you hiding in a cave when you are a prophet? You are not where you are supposed to be. You're not doing your job. And when Elijah answers that he is in grave danger, the voice of the Lord tells him to get back out there and to fight idolatry, to anoint new kings and another prophet, his successor, who will worship the Lord only and who will keep the Lord's Torah, which is being desecrated and disgraced. As followers of Jesus, we actually have a similar job description. We also are to fight idolatry, although very fortunately for us, and unlike Elijah, this does not involve violence or slaughtering the followers of Baal, so that is a relief. But we have other kinds of idolatry to take on, and idolatry, in theological terms, is putting a creature, putting any created thing, any created and therefore limited good, things that in themselves are not bad, but they're limited goods, and putting that in place of the almighty and unlimited goodness of God. It's putting a created thing in the place of God. That could be wealth or power. These are not bad in themselves. It could be our work, as in this idea of workism. It could even be our families, things that we do have responsibility for. Could be our congregation. Do we love the gospel more than we love our local congregations? Because we should. Otherwise, we become lost and we put a created thing in front of the Creator. I think that one of the most dangerous things about nostalgia is that it tends to dampen curiosity. If you're sort of stuck in the past, if you're reveling in the way things used to be, if you're intent on preservation and that's where your energy is going, you tend not to be very curious about the way things are now, or about learning new things or getting to know new people and what their lives are really like, beyond sort of a surface level of, you know, just being nice to people. You're not really interested in how is it like for people now? How is it like for people in their 20s who were young children or not even born when 9/11 happened? What's it like for them coming into the world of work? What do they care about? What's it like, you know, growing up where every time you sit down to do your homework, the whole internet is right there? What is that like? Nostalgia displaces curiosity. And whenever the church has one of its once every several hundred years rummage sales, which I think we are heading into now, Nostalgia has got to be sort of the first thing on the pile. In fact, you can't have a rummage sale if you're too nostalgic, right? If you can't let go of any of the treasured possessions. And I know some of you have been in the position of helping a parent or a friend to let go of treasured possessions that are cluttering up their life. The first thing you have to let go of is nostalgia. Can we let go of our nostalgia for the way things were and replace it with a holy curiosity about the world as it is now? Curiosity can displace nostalgia too. It goes both ways. Curiosity is lively and active, where nostalgia is stagnant. Curiosity can flow right into caring and compassion and companionship. Curiosity makes relationship possible over great differences, across generations, across class, across backgrounds. Curiosity makes a lot of things possible. The epistle today from Romans ends with Paul's plea for the gathered faithful to think of those who aren't there yet, to think of people who haven't joined them, who haven't heard about Jesus, or don't really know what that's about. But how are they to call on one in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in one of whom they have not heard? And how are they to hear without someone to proclaim him? And how are they to proclaim him unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. The gospel is still good. And it's still news. It's our job to share it in new ways that the people of this age can hear. It's our job to really look at our systems and structures and find out what's holding us back so that we can live our lives more closely patterned on Jesus. It's our job to stop treading water in our congregations and to reach out to the hand of the Lord who is longing to pull us up and out of this storm and into abundant life and into the freedom and the power of the gospel. The situation that we find ourselves in a quarter of the way through the 21st century is not sink or swim. There's a third option, to let go of what we no longer need and to reach out to the hand of the Lord and then to reach out to those around us. In God's name, amen.